TED Audio Collective.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
I realized one day they believe that they have the right to be there and be in the room, whether they're the best person for it or not. It's two different skills. That's its own skill set. And I don't have it.
From the TED Audio Collective, this is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. For 18 years, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative people about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about and working on. On this episode, Kirsten Vangsness talks about how she got into acting and playwriting in spite of being plagued by self-doubt.
I feel like a frickin' fraud, and then you just push through it.
I've been reading and loving Architectural Digest for as long as I can remember. The magazine and the website are the first places I go for design inspiration. So when I found out that the editors of Architectural Digest just launched the AD Pro Directory, the ultimate resource for matching designers with prospective clients, I knew I had to tell you all about it. Now, for the first time ever, AD's extensive community of homeowners and design enthusiasts can easily find and hire their favorite design professionals. The directory is a list of AD-approved architects, interior designers, and outdoor specialists that anyone in need of design services can access for free by searching by profession and location. If you're a design expert who is looking to grow your business and want a chance to be featured in AD, apply now. If you're a client seeking best-in-class design services, you can browse AD's extensive list of design experts. Want to be introduced to the best of the best? Explore the AD Pro Directory at architecturaldigest.com/designmatters.
Penelope Grace Garcia is a survivor. A technical analyst of the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, she has been shot, she's been arrested, she has been jilted, she has been kidnapped, all while helping to solve difficult cases. She's also the only character who has been on every episode of the show and in all of the spin-offs of the Criminal Minds TV franchise. She has played with heart and wit and great comic timing by the one and only Kirsten Vangsness. Kirsten is a stage actress who also sings. She's written plays and TV episodes and starred in her own one-woman shows. Penelope Grace Garcia is only the tip of the iceberg, and I'm here to plumb some of those depths. Kirsten Vangsness, welcome to Design Matters.
Jeez, thanks. Very exciting.
It's wonderful to have you here. And I have a question that I'm really curious about as my opening inquiry. Is it true that you chose the name Fluffy as your confirmation name?
Absolutely true. I actually wrote it in the Book of Common Prayer in Orange Crown on top of Teresa because I really desperately wanted to name a pet Fluffy, and that was far too pedestrian for my mother. So I was like, well, I'll name it. I'll name myself. And I did have this sort of round halo of fluffy hair, so it worked.
You grew up behind the Main Street on-ramp of Highway 190 next to the Anderson Fence Company in Porterville, California.
Yeah.
And I understand that you had a crush on Harriet the Spy as you were growing up.
I did.
Why Harriet the Spy?
Because she's all the things. Like, she's got that wonderful androgyny and the glasses, the commitment to an outfit for the sake of its how it made you feel, not necessarily that the glasses worked or the I can't remember what else she had on, or the flashlight. I think the flashlight worked, but something like that, and her dedication to writing and her intuitiveness and her just general chutzpah that I certainly didn't have. I wished upon it, you know, to have it when I was that age. And the writing, the journal writing and the observing of people. So yeah, it was Simon Le Bon, Harriet the Spy, and Kate Bush. That was it. Combine those, smush those into one being, and that's
your trifecta.
Yeah.
You're the daughter of elementary school teachers. Mm-hmm. Your father also sang opera and worked with the community theater. And I understand that you and your sister spent a lot of time there. And by the time you were about 7, you began playing old ladies on the stage. Yeah. So why the old ladies?
I was a weird kid. You know, people say that. Everyone says, like, a lot of people say, like, oh, I was weird and I was bullied and I was strange looking. I really, really was. it's not hyperbolic. I've always shown how I'm feeling or what's going on with me on my body. And I grew up in a very chaotic household, and I was storing information and experience and my own thoughts on my body. And as a result, I had a real weird posture. And I have this sister who is now an elementary school teacher, and she's 3.5 years older than me, and she's shorter. And she's more of like the Italian side of the family. So she's green eyes, and she can tan naturally. And she was sort of like perky and bright. So my dad, like, for instance, my dad would play Birdie in Bye Bye Birdie. And my sister would play one of the teenagers who was crazy about the star Bye Bye Birdie. And I would play one of the 70-year-old women who would be like, why is he? Or I would be one of the old ladies in Fiddler on the Roof or whatever, because my demeanor was such that I was so painfully shy. I just think the hunching over, it just fit really well, because usually that part you're just peas and carroting in the corner. But I very quickly learned to love that environment very much, just the irreverency of it all as an observer, really, then, you know, the most in the shadows kind of observer that there could be. Yeah.
Despite his interest in opera, your father didn't take care of his voice. He didn't have the career he wanted. He lost his job. He became a gambler and an alcoholic. And the family ultimately had to exist on your mom's paycheck. And you've said that being so afraid of the choices he made him cruel. And I thought that was such a kind and empathetic way of talking about someone that did really cruel things to you. I'm wondering how you got to that place where you could have that insight and empathy.
I've always been at that place. It's really weird because my childhood, my growing up, all of that is so... It survives so much my fantasy life of it. And, God, I can't remember the name of that wonderful writer, a psychologist, Gabor. Is it Gabor Mate? I might be messing up his name entirely, but he just had a new book out, and he talks about how children in the same family have completely different upbringings. I've always simultaneously hated my father, deeply hated, wanted to murder him. And at the same time, loved him. I mean, I love him like a father. I didn't have a father who did father things. I don't have one of those. I don't have that. But I remember an Amanda Palmer lyric where she says, "Fear makes you cruel." I think the reason why I liked that lyric is because I'm like, yeah. So even when I was little, and I got told all the time when I was a kid, "You're so much like your dad. You're so much like your dad." And I didn't understand that. But like, I was so close with him. I was the one that when my parents would fight when I was very small, I would come in and like try to talk it through. So I felt like I knew him so much. And because I unfortunately spent time with him as a small child where I was way adultified, I knew him. I mean, I felt like I was like a second wife and his therapist and a non-existent creature that sort of extended outside of him that was for his purposes. And so it's not like it's just there, like the empathy or the whatever, like, I don't know why, but I think I kind of lucked out of my demeanor, out of the way my brain handled stuff. I know that people have every right to feel the way that they feel about their family members, you know, and people that have wronged them. And I certainly have a lot of feelings about it. It's just, I don't know why the second I got the opportunity to not be around him, I took it. And meaning I, you know, moved into somebody else's house when I was still a teenager. I insisted on having friends around, and the whole time being told, you know, I'm being ridiculous and nothing's happening and, you know, you're crazy. And the thing is that the people close to me in that situation that are part of my family would still say that now. And we have to maintain this sort of like, it's hard because like they don't like it to be real. And I don't always know if it is real. But if I behave it, if it is, and I take care of myself as if it is, life got much better. So I don't know what to do. And I hope I answered that question.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. Memory is such a strange and kind of circuitous thing. And apparently every time you remember something, you're remembering a memory. And
right.
However, I do want to say, having spent, I don't know, the last couple of weeks deeply researching your whole life and seeing everything you've done and your stories are really consistent, which really leads me to believe that they're actually true.
Thank you. I think that's why I make things. I think that that's part of, I'll do this, I'll make things, and I'll be doing some kind of performing. No one can take that ever away from me. Like, you could pay me, you could not pay me, but I do it because it helps me process something. I mean, that's one of the best things about art. It's one of the things I know you always talk about on this, is that it's so, the ability that it has to take information that you can't understand and alchemize it into something else is the only thing that really works.
Yeah. I think that the people that don't remember things the way that we do, especially when they've imprinted in us in such a really formative manner, just don't remember it.
And it's so fascinating because there are people in my family that remember things to the T and will tell me, you know, remember when you were 4 and I was this age? And it's like, I don't remember that at all. But all I know about all of that is I am not one of the people. There are people that say, oh, to be a child again and to be in the warm embrace of it all. You could not. I will never. I am terrified of it. During the pandemic, all I thought about was all the children out there that are alone in places they can't get out of. Like, you can't, like, it is not a safe space to me. And at the same time, I think it's kept me really, it keeps all of me, that Madeleine Lingle, you're every age you've ever been. It's kept all of my ages. They're all very close to me because I feel a deep responsibility to show them where we go. You know, I don't know. I feel like sometimes I'm so cringe and so earnest because somebody else could have some really shitty things happen to them. And it's like, here I am being like, I think it's really great. And you can take care of them and show them all the good shit. And That's my experience, and I don't want to take away from other people's experiences.
Well, but I read that you weren't ever allowed to shut a door in your house, so you had no privacy.
Yeah, and that's, again, one of those things that I'm sure that this is...
Yeah, but you ended up having... You ended up losing the ability to relieve yourself for months and had to go to the doctor, which was then a re-traumatization of a body part that you were already getting trauma from.
Yeah.
With.
Yeah.
So there's evidence right there, right?
Yeah.
Hospital records.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I went to a pelvic floor physical therapist for years because I would punch people in the face if they were trying to touch me, even consensually. And the only way I could get by is if someone was non-consensually, I could somehow... But there was no privacy in my house. But then there would be these wonderful periods of time where no one would be around. And that was like really precious to me. And that part, I was able-bodied and, I don't know, the 80s and all the children went and opened your house up with a key and you were fine. That actually felt really safe to me to just sort of wander around a room, pace back and forth by myself, making up really dramatic stories. That I loved that. But then whenever there were people around, there were no locks allowed to be that you could shut a door, but you can't expect someone not to just come in. I was told multiple times that my clothes, my Christmas money I got belonged to my father. He did that to sort of all of us. I don't want to speak for them, and I want to be careful about that, but that was definitely my experience. Yeah, I don't recommend that. That's not a good form of parenting.
Well, you said that scrambling around trying to manage the emotions of this one adult was so tumultuous, it became really hard for you to focus, and it also made you, but being able to sort of de-escalate tense situations made you feel valuable.
Yeah.
And it's a skill you still have today.
Yeah.
And do you think that that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, I think it's both. I think it can be very good, but I also think it's to place your value in it, I still do it. I play this character that is also very, very good at that, but is feistier, I think, than I am, that can tolerate things in a different way than I can. I can see everything all happening at the same time. And I appreciate that, especially the kind of job I have, because, actors can be this idea that we're just sort of, myopically obsessed with ourselves. But when I'm in a room, it doesn't matter where I am, I will find the people that are, why is that person in the corner? What just happened right there? Like, I can see everything happening at the same time. And when used correctly, it's, you're one of the helpers. When used incorrectly, no. But so it's really important for me to always stay in a place of potency in like my essence qualities so that I'm not doing it from an icky place.
You said that there became a point in your life where you spent a lot of time being Agatha Christie or Angela Lansbury in your own life in an effort to try and predict what might happen next in an effort to avoid it. And I think it's when we have to do that kind of sort of sleuthing that we become hyper aware.
Oh, yeah.
Did you feel that the abuse that you suffered was your fault?
No. The straight answer is no. But, the magical thinking that happens. I deeply appreciate my magical thinking. And I live in this body, and this body is a really lovely place to be. I've made it a lovely place to be. It can be nightmare town, sure. But, I have things that I really believe in that are batshit crazy. Like, I really thought this through one time. I thought, what if we go through these multiple lives and my dad loved me so much that he decided to be the supervillain in my life to create this horrible stuff that I had to transcend, that I have transcended, that I have alchemized into other things. And when I think about it like that, I'm like, well, I guess I made it happen because I asked, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And And that's not true. Like, that didn't. But I refuse to believe that there is such a thing. I don't want to give people, I don't want to give anybody the power that there's such a thing as evil. I don't even, like, that's the funny thing about the show I'm on is, like, I don't even buy it. I think that monstrous people act in monstrous ways that make other people act like monsters. And behavior is despicable. Behavior is not okay. But I just believe in radical responsibility so much, my own. And I'm sure that that's a big flaw. But it also gets me through the day. So it's like, is it my fault? No. Do I think about it all the time that I did? I was always so interested in what was going on. And I always never wanted other people to be in the line of fire. And I have that flaw about me now, too. And I don't know if that's me trying to center myself in the drama or whatever. I've gotten better about it. But I really hope I'm making sense, because you're really...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm you know, I was trying to decide as you were talking and listening, well, should we talk about Criminal Minds now? But I want to wait because there's so much more to talk about. But I will say that I want to sort of put a pin in the notion of despicable behavior and what is it about those that have been treated despicably going one way or another.
Yeah.
And then what a show like Criminal Minds does for the people that try to rise above it.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a place in our culture for that.
Yeah.
You started keeping a journal when you were in the fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Were you writing stories? Were you recounting episodes from your life?
I was writing about things that were happening. I mean, I have a Snoopy journal. It's just like the sweetest little Snoopy journal with a lock, you know, and whatever. And you open it up and it's like, my mom and dad are bitches. I'm going to kill everyone. I mean, it is lewd. It's terrible. My sister stole it one time and she wrote this very long diatribe. But, like, I counted how I felt. I've always felt like if I can write it down and I can see it on a piece of paper, because my memory is so strange, and then to be, I'm going to say gaslighted growing up and being told, like, that's not what happened. Kirsten, you lie. You have to take that when it gets told to you so much, you take that into your world. So now I just, oh, I lie. Kirsten's a liar. Okay, got it. I'm just going to write in here what I want, because it's not going to hurt anybody. And I can be as explicit as I need to be. And if I'm lying, okay. It gave me a place. And I just think it's so valuable for anybody. At first, it's a pain, but it's like there is somebody there reflecting back eventually. At first, no, but eventually there's a witness, there's a something, and it, ooh, I mean, it took me a bit. I mean, I was bananas until my, I mean, I was bad bananas for a while. But, you know, it's turned around. It takes a bit, but yeah, it really helped me.
I feel that way too. I was bad bananas till I was about 40.
Okay, that makes me feel good.
maybe even into the 40s.
Yeah, no, maybe into the 40s. Yeah, I was making some terrible decisions, dangerous, terrible decisions. And, you know, to be sweet or to be nice, or I hate the word nice, to be kind or whatever. But then, like, even in the background, in the shadow, having someone over here that I'm intimate with that knows I'm terrible. So that, like, out in the world, I'm celebrated, but over here, this is who I really am. And this is how and that split that I grew up with, because in my house, it was so you don't share, and I couldn't help but share. And that's the other reason why the journal is very helpful, is because there are no secrets. I've been told I'm a liar my whole life, and yet I cannot keep things about me to myself. I'm compelled to share. So it's a weird dichotomy, and the journal helped.
Well, it's so interesting that you were writing so much, but you were also painfully shy. I know that by the time you entered eighth grade, you were so shy you stopped talking.
Yeah.
And you did poorly in school. And by the time you went to Cerritos High School,
uh-huh.
Your mom gave you an ultimatum. You had to take shop or drama.
Right.
Now, I find this so interesting. Why did she choose those particular topics?
Well, I think that the getting me out of my shell, and I had already, since I had done the community college and when I was in junior high in Porterville, I really did love drama class, but I was bullied, thrown in trash cans, and I was the girl that people invite. You know, I got invited to one sleepover once, and it was legitimately just, this is the girl we're going to terrorize. Like, it was relentless, and it was slightly better than being at home, but I didn't like it. You know what I mean? You don't know when you're going to get punched in the face. And I would make it worse, because I would say things like, I'm like Gandhi, I'm a peacekeeper. You're getting punched. Or I would make jokes about it or whatever. And I would make it would become more of a thing, because I was so, I mean, I think I still am invested in being a little bit of a weirdo, but like really, I was so weird. And when we had moved, and I was like, I can't take it. Like, and we moved to Cerritos, and Cerritos was, I remember the people had money, and you're like, there were girls in whole outfits in yellow. I thought, how much money do you have to have? You can have a whole outfit in the color yellow. And I just decided to stop. So, and I was not, it was very hard to pay attention in school. And my parents were in tumultuous situations, so they're not really paying attention, and sort of like every person for themselves. But my mother is wonderful and was struggling in this relationship with a guy that I really think, you know, she came from a place of like, you're supposed to be with a man to, you know, for the girls to be in a stable. So I really think she was trying. I mean, I know she was trying. She was trying really hard. But I think that, you know, she has these moments my whole life where she's just done these sort of incredible things that someone else might be like, what is that? It's like, she's the perfect mom for me. And that was like one of those things where she was like, you can do this or do this. And I didn't want to do shop because that seemed scary. And drama seemed a different kind of scary. Shop seemed boring, scary, and rules, and drama just seemed like terrifying. But like, I would love to do it. But like, I've always had that thing of like, oh, I'm not invited to that party. And that seemed like, no one wants me. I'm not the person that gets to go to that party. And then I went to class, and our first two assignments, we didn't have to talk. And I got an A. And
it was pantomime, right?
Yeah. And I had never gotten an A on anything. And just, I mean, I like, teachers were always like, Kirsten's really creative or whatever, and they liked me and all that. But like, just to get an A in something for just trolloping around in my imagination, that was. And I was hooked.
In 10th grade, you got the part of a heroin dealer in a school play called Juvie.
Yeah, I did.
About a juvenile detention center. And you've talked about how your teacher put Post-it notes all over the classroom before you went on stage. Why did she do that?
It sort of like builds you up. And it was like quotes, Stanislavski quotes, all this. And it was real. I mean, those entering drama was like, oh, this is the place. And, you know, I had the crush on my friend James, who I then eventually moved into his house and lived with him. My other best friend, Michael, who transitioned to 9 physical in 96, but was just a genius. And they were both in the play with me. And of course, in this version of Juvie, there was only a set of bars separating the male and the female, the you know, it's binary, but in the juvenile detention center. And she had one Post-it, which in all it said was, love the art in yourself and not yourself in the art.
Mm.
And that was everything to me, because I think that part of my, like, I'm not invited to the party was like, I love this thing so much. I don't even know if I'm good enough or worthy enough. I mean, I still have that so deeply, that kind of weird impostery, kind of, it's gross. But like, that kind of gave me permission, and I understood it. It was like, oh, that's how I believe art is. It's like, I'm not special. Everybody's special. There's this big open space that it's my job to keep as open as possible, but it's got on it like little roots sticking out and like stuff from your life and your own, my own, you know, stuff. And then when whatever that juice is that you create from comes pumping up from the earth through me and out my mouth or out my hands or whatever, it's covered with my special sauce, but it's not me that makes it special. It's that. You know, so, and that also, it, since I felt so gross and I can go through that so much, the art isn't gross. And I get to be a part of it. And it loves me just like it loves everybody else. And it gets to go through me and through everybody. That felt like the safest, wildest thing in the world. Like, that's what I serve forever.
You won an award for your part in Juvie for outstanding cast member.
I did.
And I believe you still have that award in your living room, right?
Absolutely do.
It's brass comedy and tragedy mask with a fake marble base.
It's true. I do.
That's when you knew you wanted to be involved in drama, theater.
Yeah.
At being an actor for the rest of your life. But you were also convinced that in order to do that, you would be a starving artist subsisting on cat food for the rest of your life.
I was told, again, this wonderful thing about my mom. She was like, you're never going to make a living doing that. Like, it's literally impossible. And I was like, yep. Like, I just kind of knew, and that was fine. But it's so crazy because it was the thing I was good at. Like, so I was getting, like, I got a little, like, $100 scholarship. I almost flunked out of high school, and I got this scholarship. And I remember the kid, Paris Maida, who got a perfect score on the SAT, was sitting next to me at the award ceremony, and he said, I really thought you were good in that play. And I was like, Paris Maida? No, he's like the smartest kid in school. What? Like, I got accolades for it. And then I, you know, went to community college and went to college and was like getting attention for this thing that I kind of knew, like, it's never gonna be able to do it. And then I got an audition for a movie, and Mally Finn, big casting director. Her daughter casts, I think, the Star Wars trilogy things now, but she casts like Titanic and stuff. I got an audition with her at Paramount Studios, and I went in and I did my audition, and she said, so what are you going to do when you graduate college? And I was like, I'm going to go be an actor. You know, I'm saying it very tentatively. And she says, no, I mean, you're not old enough to be a character actor. You're not fat enough. You're not young enough. You're not pretty enough to be, you know, the main girl. Like, she listed off all these things. And I walked out of the room and I was like, well, for a moment I thought, like, I can do this. And then I was like, nope, I absolutely can't. But it was the most freeing thing in the world. I was like, oh, okay. Okay. Because I think she ended up saying, like, if you're lucky, in 10, 15 years, you'll age into being a character actor. She wasn't wrong. And it was very freeing to be like, okay, I just need to have like 16 day jobs. But every time I quit acting, I was miserable. So I always say to people, like, if you open that Pandora's box, we're meant to create whatever it is. And you have your day job, you have your thing, but you take care of that art. Because it's not the person who's on the TV show or on the Doritos commercial or whatever that's the actor. It's the person that's sitting in their living room with their friends reading a play or at their community theater doing. It's the art that matters. It's like, that is so valuable. So for me, that was like more galvanizing, and like, you cannot take this away from me. I just won't get paid for it.
You have written that you walked out of that audition with this woman and you heard a big cracking noise, which was your dreams dying.
Yes.
So what gave you the motivation to go on? I mean, was it, I mean, you, waiting 15 years to age into being a character actress is not a lot of motivation.
It shifted, because motivation is such a strange thing, I think, in general, even now. Something you love to do, like a dream you love to do. And by the way, I lived down the street from where that my dreams were cracking, in a place in town where I never thought I would be able to live. So it does sort of happen, I think. But like, I just, especially in Los Angeles, there's such a huge disparate between, you know, the above the glass ceiling and below. It's like, you can still make things. So the desire went from, oh, I'm going to be an actor and make money doing this, to I'm going to be an actor. So that's not stopping me from auditioning for every play I can think of, or, you know what I mean, saying yes to things. That didn't stop me from doing that. And that's what I wanted. And it was kind of freeing, because I've always been terrible at schmoozing. I'm terrible. Spelling correctly on my resume, all of that stuff. So it kind of like took that off. And I just went toward creating. Like, that's what I did. And yes, it's terrifying, because you're like, how am I going to pay rent? You know what I mean? Like, I lived in a $500 a month guest house that I could not afford and never made my rent. But I did it and I was happy. And that's one of the other things I always think about, like, what's the worst thing that's going to happen if you go after that thing you want? And everyone can say, like, oh, have you met Kirsten? She's 95 and she's never become a famous actress, but gosh, is she happy? I just didn't even think about it, like how to get there. I just created stuff.
Does this agent or audition person know about your career now?
Oh, I think Mally Finn transitioned to non-physical, but I do. Her ex-husband was one of the teachers at Cal State Fullerton. And it is really strange, you know, because now everybody at my old schools and stuff like that, it's like, oh, Kirsten, you know, and it's nice. I mean, when I was in college, I definitely felt like I was getting, and in high school, I felt like I was getting accolades for what I did from teachers and stuff like that. It is funny when people treat you differently, you know? And I remember, like I said, I remember all the ages. I don't hold grudges or anything like that. It's just, I'm very aware of how fickle all that is and whatever. And this whole thing is so wonderful to get paid to do the thing I love. There's parts of it, though, that are strange. Like that, where, like, everybody likes you. A lot of people did not like me. You know, like I was not wanted in the room. So it's very strange. And I still don't always know that I'm wanted. And now it's such bullshit because I think it's so part of my personality that I think I've decided that it's part of my charm. So, oh my God, what would happen if I actually thought I was wanted in places and then I wouldn't be? Like, it's a whole fucking mind trip.
Yeah, but no, I know that too. I feel like if I ever really felt the way I know other people feel about me, people that love me, I think I'd be intolerable.
Yeah, I worry about that too.
Yeah.
Maybe we can make a pact.
That sounds good.
I'll make a pact with you.
I would absolutely do that with you. Absolutely. So you talked about all of these other jobs you got. So after you graduated with a 4.0 average from
college.
And I
almost flunked out of,
So. And afterward, you got many different jobs. And this is just some of what I found. You worked at a group home with kids that couldn't succeed in foster care. Mm-hmm. You worked at a nature center. You were a substitute teacher at a public school. You were a bank teller, a grant writer, a personal assistant, and an animal feeder at the zoo.
Uh-huh. I worked at a murder mystery dinner theater. I taught children how to babysit and how to not smoke while I was a smoker for 5 minutes. I worked at, you said banker. There's other ones, but those are, yeah.
Which was your most favorite and which was your least?
Most favorite would definitely be substitute teacher or working at the group home. Both of those were, the group home was so interesting because it was before, now you actually need a degree to do that. But the law was such, it really taught me a lot about my own childhood and to interface with kids and help them. And it kind of helped me. And I found that I then took that and then I went into substitute teaching with this sort of superpower where I'm going to like you and I'm not going to like your behavior. I'm not going to shame you, but I will absolutely do what I say. So if I give you a warning and I tell you something and you do, I will absolutely do that. You know, so kids really trusted me and I had that real like Mary Poppins kind of thing. So I loved that. And the job I hated the most would be I was a banker. I worked as a bank teller. I was not a banker. And I had one outfit that I got from Marshall's that fit me that looked official. And I would wear it almost every day. And I would consistently be over or under by 10 grand, like easily. And just every day. And then I would get in trouble and then I would panic. So that was probably my least favorite job. Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
While still working at all your day jobs, you got a role in the 1998 film Sometimes Santa's Gotta Get Whacked and a role in the science fiction television sitcom Phil of the Future. And you were also doing improv shows in Anaheim Hills. And then you started to watch all your friends that were acting majors in college go get real jobs. So they started to quit or acting?
No, people start realizing like, oh, this acting thing isn't paying or the whatever. So they get another job, you know, and then you've got some people that do book work and stuff. And I was having like a real hard time because I was living in Anaheim. I was living more like in Orange County, like Long Beach. And I was driving up to sometimes do plays in LA, sometimes do theater in Orange County, just wherever I could do it. I was doing it. And I would be around people and someone like book a job on, I don't know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, book a job on a commercial. And I'd be like, they're not even that great. Or sometimes it would be, but I'd be like, what? Why are they? How come I can't? Like, because I would be told, like, you're very good at this. And I would win. We would do these monologue festivals at one of the theater companies I was in where you'd get like $50 if you won, and it was $50 to do it. So I could do it. I could win every time, then take the money and do it again to like meet casting people and stuff. But I couldn't book anything. And I realized one day, I was like, oh my gosh. They believe that they have the right to be there and be in the room, whether they're the best person for it or not. It's two different skills.
Yeah.
That's its own skill set. And I don't have it at all. And I don't know if I ever will. But that was amazing. And then also coming to terms with the fact that this thing I love so much, the idea of getting paid for it or to be responsible for a certain thing, that was a definite, that's how I was getting my own way. And this is where I mean, like, yes, it sucks and probably is dumb to say that everything is my fault. However, the radical responsibility aspect of it where you go, oh, this is what I'm doing wrong, and attacking that, for me, it's a more active way to live than saying, oh, it's because Hollywood doesn't understand me. It was like, well, this is what I'm doing wrong. And I kind of got into either, well, okay, I guess I don't know how to do that, and maybe I'll learn. But that was very eye-opening to me.
So what do you mean by radical responsibility?
I mean, like, what I wanted to say is it's all my fault, but that's probably not the right way to say it. I mean that I have this universe in here that's mine. This is mine. This is like I tell my nieces, like when they were in high school and they'd do stuff that I'd think, you're not going to like that you did that, you know, in a few years. I would say, look, you know, one of my nieces, her name is Lindsay. I was like, it's Lindsay Town, population one, and you're the mayor, and you're the constituents, and you're everything. So that's how I feel about me. Because, like, I had my own way of doing things growing up. Like, there was nobody out there advocating in a way I wanted them to. Like, I've figured it all out from just, like, in me, population me, And I, you know, a lot of times I felt like everything was my fault. So if it's all my fault, it's also, well, I guess I should work on the, I'm going through it in real time right now. I guess I should work on the, like, I did it too. But I like to think that if it's my universe and I take responsibility for everything, it makes me feel more powerful. I read this book one time, and I'm now pals with him, called The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks. And he talks about upper limiting and your happiness threshold. And I don't even want to give anything away because you're nodding, so you know what I'm talking about. I want everyone to go get that book and read it. But like that kind of like, what's so wrong with thinking that I made it all happen? It's worked for me. And it's completely insane. But it works for me. And I'm not trying to say that it works for everybody, but like, that kind of radical responsibility of like, it's up to me to take care of this universe and anything that goes on with me. I'm going to assume that I chose this moment that's happening right now. I'm going to act like I chose it myself. You know what I mean? That's an Eckhart Tolle quote. But like, I'm going to act like this is, and I think that's what I mean by it.
It's so interesting because I vacillate between thinking that everything is my fault and mm-hmm. thinking that nothing is my fault.
Yes. Oh, I think I absolutely do too. But like, look, we're doing this interview and you're going to ask me questions, and that persona, which I do think is me most of the time, is going to come out, and I'm going to be the upstanding girl who says radical responsibility. And when I'm not here, I'm going to think, you know, because also radical responsibility means I'm responsible for how much cake I eat or whatever. And I like to think that like it's not fair and that other people get to eat more cake than I don't know. You know what I mean? So it's not true. It's what I want. It's my religion, a part of my religion of choice. Kind
Absolutely.
Of a thing.
I think I want to be the girl with the most cake, but I don't want to gain any weight when I eat it.
That's right. That's the line of that whole album song right there. Yeah.
Let's get Courtney on the line. Yeah. when you were 33 years old, you got a call from a friend who told you about a role for a scene in a television pilot called Quantico. Mm-hmm. And you were asked to read for a part for a character named Garcia, which was originally written for a young Latino man. Mm-hmm. What made your friend call you?
So I had done a lot of theater, as I said, and a friend of mine, Gina Garcia Sharp, called me and said, do you want to come in for this? She was working for the casting director. And she was like, you're never going to get this part. But she had been, she's a wonderful actor, and been working on the other side of the table to kind of figure out, like, how does this work? So your job also being an associate like that is to bring in other actors that you know to be like, look, to make, just be like, look, I know good actors. So the idea of come in, make my friend look good, very freeing. That's what she needed. And they needed these, it was very last minute because they realized the show, they were shooting the pilot. They had already cast the guy. They had filmed him and then realized the show's too guy heavy. We only have one woman. We need a woman right there. So she called. Now this is when I was 33, I'm now 50, so do the math. And we need to talk about the elephant in the room that a Norwegian girl would never be playing Penelope Garcia if it was happening now. And that's the correct thing. Am I super grateful for it and all of that? Absolutely. But I am aware of the benefits that white privilege has bestowed upon me. And I want to say that out loud. So I went in and go make my friend look good and say these two lines. And then you're cast in this pilot and you're going to be on it for 2 seconds. And they flew me to Canada and I had to find a birth certificate because I had never been out of the country. And I was terrified. And I go in this room and I memorize my lines. So it's this technical stuff. They say, bring your own clothes. I'm somewhere between like a size 12 and a size 16. And that is a weird, magical, unknown size in Hollywood. They think 0 or 22. It's like the middle part doesn't exist. So I brought in my own clothes and I didn't have a suit. I didn't have anything. They were like, what are these? And I dressed like a space pirate. And so then they put me in a green sweater and they sat me down and they said, say these words. And they, do you know who Shamar Moore is? No, I know. He's very cute. You're talking to him. And I was scared out of my mind. And I said the words. And I remember the director coming over and saying, could you be funny? And yes, I can be funny. And I'm being paid for the thing I love. And I do it. And I think I was, I don't remember what happened. And then that was supposed to be it. And I remember when I got done, I shook the hand of the writer. And as I was holding his hand, and this is the, I don't do these things as much anymore, but this is things I have to train out of myself. I grabbed his hand as I was shaking his hand and I put it to my own forehead. And then I proceeded to thunk my own forehead and say repeatedly, did I butcher your words? Did I butcher your words? And then he said, he patted my hand and he said, we'll see you back in LA. I thought, oh, I don't know what that means. and then a few months later, they did a second episode and they asked me to come for the second episode. And then I did the second episode and then I tested really well, apparently. And I got to keep going. I actually have been in all Criminal Minds episodes except episode 5
of
the first season.
I didn't realize
that. Yeah. Most people don't. I think they mentioned me in that. But when I wasn't on episode 5, I was like, oh. What's funny is my mom and my sister had planned an intervention for me. They were going to sit me down. They got a hotel room in Ojai. I remember they were spending this money to get this hotel room. And they told me it was a pre-tell intervention. We're going to tell you you need to quit acting. You need to quit acting. And I had to call them and say, I got this job. And they were like, you have to cancel. You have to say no. Kirsten, you can't keep doing this. You can't keep lying to yourself. I said, no, this is a real job. I'm taking it. And I went and I did it. And this was the job that it was.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. record yourself presenting, and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
Hey, y'all, it's Elise. I have another podcast to tell you about. It's called In the Making. It's an original podcast brought to you by Adobe Express. It's the all-in-one content creation app included in your Creative Cloud membership. In the Making takes an honest look at the challenges and rewards of being part of the creator economy. The series kicks off with Puno, who is a creative director and educator. On the show, host Teresa Au explores how you can use the principles of design to create a career you love. Puno did it. Puno is a web designer and content creator and the founder of an online education platform called I Love Creatives. And on the show, Puno shares her journey from working on the Call of Duty video game to building both a design studio and a trade school for digital design. Puno has practical advice for taking a thoughtful and iterative approach to career building. Most importantly, this show is actionable. It's about how you can take your own next step in the creative world and into the creator economy. It'll help you discover creative, intriguing people who are making a living, and it'll probably inspire you no matter what you do. I know it certainly did for me. Search for In the Making in your podcast player. My thanks to In the Making and Adobe Express for their support.
So Garcia the Latino Man became Penelope Garcia because the TV executives thought the pilot didn't have enough female characters. What did you say in those two lines to get them to, I mean, you weren't even in any kind of interesting attire to...
No, I tested it. I remember them saying, like, there's these knobs, you know, they have people watch it. And then they said that my knob got turned as much, if not more, than Mandy's. It was like a Mandy Patinkin. It was like 100%. And my only answer is that, I don't know. I just think I was different looking than what people were used to seeing. And maybe that was it. Also, they paired me with someone very traditionally attractive. And I'm not saying I'm not trying to say anything about myself. I'm saying that, like, usually someone traditionally attractive, I think more like of a size of a woman. We tell these stories that men are attracted to, like, women that are much smaller than them. And that is a lie. And so I think that maybe that shown that, like, the sizes of people can be diverse and attraction can be diverse, that people really took to that. And me and Shamar, when we shot that second episode, we had a scene together. And even before, when we were in the table read, we were joking around. And that joking around, one of the writers heard, and they ended up putting it in the script. And then we were in that second episode together with these lines that were very flirty. And we both realized, like, we have so much chemistry. And we get along just weirdly well. Not weirdly, it was just like, we don't know each other. And it was like, we just knew each other. And that, I think, helped me keep that job because he's so charismatic on screen and I got to sort of be his necessary thing. And
Lois Lane to his Superman.
Yeah. And he really treated me like that, which is, I think, the thing that's super valuable about this. It wasn't like, it was a real, genuine, not placating, not anything like that. It's like a real thing. And that was super great. And I think that that's what kept me on the show. It was the mix of that and, like, they did borrow from me, meaning the costume designer, BJ Rogers, did a bang up job of that. And that was a lot of her. But she was originally putting me in one kind of thing. And then the writers would see me, you know, go out of my dressing room and, like, can she wear that? Like, and so they started borrowing some of my clothes. And then she was, meanwhile, kind of creating it. And then I was hoping that I got to keep the job. So I kept leaving props on her desk, which by the end and now on the show is like a living space. I put things there that fans have given me when they come to see plays, homemade pens, all kinds of things. So it was like, I thought, well, if they fire me, I'm going to have to come back and get all this stuff back. So it was kind of like a job security kind of a thing. But I think that that mix of, like, I'm a very do-it-yourself person. Like, plays I write, things I do, I like to, like, do it all myself. So, like, I put that on that, you know, too. Because at first they didn't give her much. And I could see who she could be. And then they let me keep making her.
You really created her, though, in so many ways.
Yeah.
You brought her to life.
I mean, I think it. What's so great about it is she's like a lesson in yes and. Because, you know, the writers would write something. I'm like, oh, okay. Okay, so that's true now. Oh, that's true now. But I would come in and I would like, I'm going to change this line and I'm going to put it like this. Or I'm going to make it like this. And I'm a theater girl, so I can do something in one take. So they come in and they prepare for like, okay, we've got, Kirsten's got to do 2 pages of exposition. This is going to take us 2 hours. And I'd pop it out in one take and we'd be done. And then I would say, can I say it this other way that I memorized it? Because I added this word. They'd be said, that word doesn't sound even a real word. Kirsten. Yeah, but, or I would, me and Shamar would call each other and be like, okay, if you say this, I'm going to say this. We'd rehearse our scenes on the phone. And then I'd come in and be like, no, I already talked to him. And he said I could do this. So they were yes-anding me. I was yes-anding them. And then she just kind of blossomed into this thing, you know? And I'm quite honored that I get to be her guardian because I think she's super special.
Absolutely. She has become really a sort of archetype in every sort of criminal procedural. There's always a really unusual, edgy, genius, subversive character now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all based on
this. Yeah, and when you think about it, it's like Money Penny, what was it, Mitchell or whatever from Alias, Abby from NCIS. But I was definitely her, she was definitely part of that whole like brainiac.
Yeah, but Money Penny was traditional.
Exactly. But I feel like that was the closest they would allow us to get. And then you go into this, which is like this woman who is truly her own thing and like a, like she's her own thing. Like, and no one is like, and what I love is I've heard that like behavioral analysis at Quantico felt like they could be a little more who they wanted to be because she could, you know, she was like that. And I don't know anything about computer analytics. So I was so happy that like, that they felt as seen as they did, because that's always been really important to me. And I also think it's really important to highlight women who can do those kinds of things, you know?
Yeah, but, I mean, that's also what I appreciate so much about how you and Shamar engaged with each other, because he was so clearly in awe of your brilliance and your beauty that it showed an entire world that women don't only have to look a certain way or be a certain way to be interesting to the opposite sex.
Absolutely. And for me, I had to learn that in real time. I remember my dad had gotten sick. He was, I mean, it sounds bad, but he was always dying. And so he'd be like, oh, he's dying, and you know, go to the hospital and, you know, whatever. And it was one of those times, it was like second episode, third episode. And I had been at the hospital and whatever, and I had gotten any sleep and I had stayed at a friend's house. I had to be at work the next day and I was late. And I mean, if you ask anybody at work, I've been on 320 some episodes. I've been late like twice. And so I was late. And I remember because they were concerned. I was new to the job and they were not happy that I was late and I didn't want to tell them what was going on. And so I went and I did my job as best as I could. And I remember driving home and I was like, I'm at choice right now. You can be the girl that you always have been, who sabotages everything, who doesn't believe that you have the right to be here, or you can just fucking pretend that you're this girl that this man thinks is, you know, this Shamar dude thinks is hot. You can just pretend. Who cares? And I was like, no, I can't, because I'm still the girl who lives in this car, who can't keep it clean. I was like, you're just going to be that girl. There's never going to be a moment that I'm going to be outside my body and get to observe and be like, whoa, she's cool. Like, I'm never going to have that. And it was like a little sad, but then it was like, okay. And then I just like was able to like go in there and play an extended game of pretend, which I will argue it makes your life, because at a certain point that pretend becomes real. And if that's what you got, like, why not? What's the harm?
Absolutely. You know, I've been a long, long time fan of the show, as is my wife. And we also love Law & Order SVU. And over the years, when people ask, you know, what are your favorite TV shows? And I've always said Criminal Minds and Law and Order SVU. And there have been times where I actually have said that my childhood was like an episode of Criminal Minds and SVU. And people then question, why do you like these shows so much? They don't seem to get it. Like, why do you want to keep triggering yourself? And why do you want to keep doing something that's going to make you feel bad again? And I'm like, no, it's the opposite. Seeing the bad guys always get caught on these shows, seeing justice be done, I go to sleep feeling safer. And I'm wondering if that's something that you've heard from other folks.
Oh, yeah. Joe Mantegna just sent us. And I mean, look, it's the greatest job in the world. I need to say that out loud. I work with people that are like genuinely my family. As I was driving here, I was getting 12 texts. When my phone lights up and it's like 47 text messages, I'm like, oh, Padgett or Aisha or Joe, that we're very close. So Joe just got a thing from somebody who was in a harrowing, dangerous situation and actually used things that he learned from the show in this moment. And that's happened more than a few times. And yes, I definitely feel that. For me to be in it and doing it is where I draw the line. It's hard for me to watch. I have such a big imagination that I will actually think my friends are in trouble. There's a part of my nervous system that doesn't get it. But I agree with you. I mean, it's by the grace of God that my neuronet made choices. You know, yes, I would like to think it's because of some things that I did too, but like I interface sometimes because of my life with someone who is very borderline and had a very kind of similar tumultuous upbringing. And they are unpleasant and unhappy and, oh, all of that. And you're like, by the grace of God, my brain was able to turn things off or whatever. And I've got my own bag of rocks. I'm not saying that, but like that to me is always like, there are monsters. There are people who behave monstrously. And that's the other thing I love about being Penelope is Penelope, you know, and that's, I definitely gave that to her. There are rules to Penelope that I adhere to. I've never on that show, if they wrote anything violent that they've unintentionally or on purpose sexualized, Penelope's not doing it. Like, I will take that line out. I will whatever. And they've always been very respectful about things like that. That she sees the evil behavior and not the evil person, that she maintains that people were all of us were babies and all of us had horrible things, you know what I mean? And that like, you have to be able to see all of the thing. And I think that that makes her even more tenacious about, you know, no, you can't do that. I appreciate that about her.
Well, one other thing that I really appreciate is that they have, over the years, given Penelope a sex life.
Yeah, she was the first person, actually, who slept with anybody on the show. And she's made some real doozies of choices. And it's been really good for me. It was strange because I came out right before I got the job. And I was like, okay, this is part of the thing that I need to handle is that I didn't know I was gay. And I fell in love with this woman and I was madly in love and that was that. And I thought, oh, I figured it all out. And then I was doing this show and it was really weird because everyone's like, oh, Shamara's so cute. Whatever. I was like, and that was the other reason I was like, oh, I'm positively gay because I love him, but I don't have any, nope. Like who I'm going home with is what all I want. I don't, don't want any of these people. I'm around all these very good looking people. Nope. Just want this. Everything seemed to line up. It all made sense. And the show actually through time, I've like, oh, and then Garcia is absolutely queer. And I've always known that. But I was like, oh, but she's not gay. And then to kind of come full circle and be like, oh, wait, no. I also want to go out with men sometimes and then women. So, okay, now I'm sticking with this one heteronormative relationship and I'm a queer person. And I have come to peace with that. Then I get to watch Garcia kind of be that. She kind of is up there doing stuff that I'm sometimes like running toward that nobody even knows I've built this sort of Bible for her, but I know, and it informs choices. You know what I mean? And you know, the entire time I had an impeach the motherfucker already sticker in her office that no one knew about. And then anytime someone would find out, I would get a new one and put it up. Like, and like that whole desk has been nothing but like just a progressive manual of like,
yeah, it's gonna anti-racism. Need to go in the Smithsonian someday.
It's a whole thing. Yeah. Yeah.
In addition to acting in all but one of the episodes of the entire series, including the new series that's recently come back, thank goodness, you have also co-written 5 of them, including the first series finale, which was incredible. What first inspired you to try your hand at writing for the show?
I thought it was an impossible feat. And we were in contract negotiations, which are a fascinating thing where, you know, your people say they want this much and then the studio says we'll give them this much. So we were going through that. And look, I'll do this for free. I don't care. However, it was interesting to me that we had gotten to a point that I was sort of, because people had gone and come back, you know, there were people that were more senior than me, but they had gone and come back. So in that going and coming back, I was more senior. So I had become the most senior female in the room temporarily. And why were we not getting paid as much as the men? So this was I was like,
yeah.
If someone can tell me, now I get it for me. Because this is the first job I've had, but that person has had all these other jobs, and this person has all these other jobs. And so you need to explain that to me. And they weren't giving me answers, and I was to the point that I was like, I just want to conversate, just ABC, CBS, just call me up, and we can just talk about it. And once you tell me why, then maybe, but I don't get it. I just don't get it. I'm not trying to be greedy. I'll do this for, but that don't make no sense, because the only thing I can see that's different is organs. Like, but again, if one of the other two women who had way more work under their belt, they were getting paid more, I could wrap my head around that, but I couldn't. And I had been very vocal about it. And they kept trying to like eke it up and try to please me. And I was like, no, you don't seem to understand. You're going to pay them as much as me. And that's the end of this conversation. Like, they didn't seem to get it. And then they bumped it. I got my way. But not exactly. Like, I was still, I was going to say yes. But my boss called me and she said, what do you think about co-writing an episode with me? And she's like, I can do that. I don't think they're going to go any farther in this, but I can do that. And I was like, okay. And so I did. And I was terrified in my mind. And, you know, I'm not, my first drafts of things are literally like, you know, Rossi, you know, that's the name of a character on a show. I'll write Rossi and then walks in and says something relevant. The next character, they say something to agree with him. Third character says something completely opposite to disagree. That's an anecdote about a killer. Like, I would write out like that and then like fill it in. I'm good, though, at writing scenes that had to do with interpersonal stuff. And Erica knew that about me. So we just would flip. Like, I'd write an act, she'd write an act, and then we'd swap. And then she'd clean mine up. And then hers are perfect. So I'd like add a joke or something like that. But that's how we've done it. But she's one of my dearest friends. She's just a lovely human being who happens to be brilliant and have like just the most creatively disturbing ideas to write these episodes about. So we talk about our families and, you know, I've told her all my relationship problems. I've braided her hair so many times. Like, you know, we just sit and talk and eat potato chips and like write these episodes. So it's just an exercise in hanging out. And then somehow or another, we've popped these episodes out that I'm really happy that my name is lucky enough to be on them.
Well, you've often referred to your work on Criminal Minds as your fancy day job. And I want to talk about some of the work you do when you're not doing your fancy day job. Here are just a few of the things that you've made. This is a bit of a monologue I'm going to make now. You were the star and executive producer of the film noir spoof Kill Me Deadly in 2007. You starred in the West Coast premiere of Neil LaBute's Fat Pig at the Geffen Playhouse, for which you received a Best Actress Garland Award. You received another Ovation Best Actress nod for the show Everything You Touch at Boston Court, an LA Weekly Best Playwright of the Year nomination for your production of Potential Space, and won the Los Angeles Drama Circle Best Comedic Actress. You wrote a one-person show titled Mess, which, by the way, Neil Gaiman has called his favorite one-person show ever, which you performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and was greeted with 5-star reviews and sold-out shows. You also created a 2-season show on YouTube during COVID titled Kirsten's Agenda. Congratulations on all of this work, as well as some of the other work I haven't gotten to yet, which we're going to talk about now. Okay?
Yeah. That sounds, when you put in a list like that, I'm like, oh, she's done things.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about your one-woman show, Mess. It's a very intense, beautiful, I think autobiographical show with a lot of trauma and vulnerability and emotion. What was your motivation for doing this one-woman show, and how did you pull it off? How did you put it all together?
I am a bit of a mess. I've had to embrace that about myself. Like, you know, I need to see everything out, so things will be out a lot. I talk in a very circuitous way. I'm a little clumsy. And I'm a member of a theater company in Los Angeles called Theater of Note. And when the Hollywood Fringe Festival came around years ago, pre-Criminal Minds, I decided I was going to write a show and have it in the Fringe. And at first, it was just me reading some stuff from my journal. And then the next year, I did it again. I called it Mess Again. And I wrote a song. The song stayed. And then I put other things in it. And then I did it again the next year, and I put other things in it. So it's been like this little living document. The thing that's important to me about it and why I needed to write it and whatever, I have this belief that time happens at the same time, and that this is another thing that gets me through the day. I like to think that if we can be as gentle and good to ourselves now, that we can go back and we can show all those little parts that didn't get it, that we can heal that timeline. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if then we could heal the timeline back and generations and stuff like that? I don't know if it's true. Gets me through the day. And also, I had a lot of anxiety growing up, and I still do sometimes, about falling asleep and death and just the magical realism in the good and bad ways that invade my mind. And it was a way for me to work on that. And then in 2016, when the election happened, I really didn't understand why that happened. And I had so much pain about it. And I was like, but isn't there something common? And so then it became this pursuit to me, that play. I wanted to show that play in places that, so I went to Alabama and I did it. I found a theater there and I was like, I'm going to send you this play. This is the play I want to do. I'll give you all the profits and I'll donate to a public school around there. And it was, you know, deeply in the red part of it. And did it. And it's a lot about, you know, dealing with the external, the fear that's out here and the bad that's out here, and understanding that my inside contains the monster, right? And the monster's out here because I made it happen. So part of that 2016 thing for me was like, I made this happen through my own ignorance, through my own not participating, through my own ways that I beat myself up on the inside. I've allowed that to happen outside. It was so cool to go into this environment, bikers, Jews for Jesus bikers and stuff that watched it, that were like, I love this show. And you're like, oh, I know we voted for different people, but we have something. And it kind of proved this idea to me that, like, oh, we have all these broken parents and we're all figuring out different ways of dealing with them. And some of our ways was like, no, let's make him run the country because this time we'll do it right or something. I don't know. So that's what it became. And then it's one of those things, like, I haven't done it now in a few years, but I will probably pick it up again and do it again. Because every time I do it, it's like clunky. I sent you a thing of like, I recorded it, I did the best I could, you know, and every time I get a little braver and I can kind of step outside of it and try it again. Whenever I've done it, I've only done it in small spaces, you know, and it feels like we did something together, like the room did something together. And to me, that's one of the most valuable things to me about making art. I think it's that thing of being a kid and feeling like no one sees me and no one likes me. Like, I see all of this. And I know you look at me like this now, but I'm not. You know what I mean? And if you feel like how I did, like, we're all the same thing. And so, like, I love that.
Yeah, you start the show with a song. You get your audience to sing in full-throated voices. These are the lyrics. And we all are a mess, I guess. And we all are a mess, I guess. And we cover up our mess with stuff. And we act like we're totally cool.
It's true.
At 3 years old, you experience sexual trauma. And in the play, you state, there is just me inside me when it happens. Some dirty mark that you can make go away. Do you still feel that way?
Sometimes. I used to feel that way all the time because I kept it so secret. And I think sometimes I wished I just knew. I wish everybody knew, or I wish it was very specific, because I've lost caring how covert or overt it was. I know it was. And I've gone around my head like, oh, I'm so sensitive. So probably what I did is I probably read his mind. He was probably thinking something bad around me. So it's my fault, like all of that. So it doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
It really doesn't matter. I do know that that has always been, like, I've always just felt like me. When something like that happens in your life, I think that whatever higher self angel person that lives inside of you, she just fucking shows up. And whether she can help you or not, you have this moment where you're like, I've just always felt like me. I've never felt like I'm a grown-up. And that was the three-year-old, because the three-year-old was in a grown-up situation where she had to just be like, okay, there's something's happening, like, and I don't know what. So, like, one of the things that I'm able to do is I'm very good buddies with my shame. People can either severely dislike me because they have a hard time with their own shame, or they can feel very, I can feel very dear to them. So on top of the fact that I am the deus ex machina of a TV show where I always save the day, you know, that's why I'm very used to people coming up to me at airports and things and just embracing my body because they have to, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's a little like, whoa. Also, I think it's because I kind of always feel like, ugh, I'm a little gross, but I'm going to do that anyway. I'm a little gross, but I'm going to do it anyway. Like, there's always that thing that's in there that I'm like, ah, and you probably know that I am. But I try to, and maybe I'm not for the next 5 minutes. Like,
but I think we all are at the same time. Like, yeah. We're all, that's what we all are. That's, yeah. You say that some people see mess and they find it heartbreaking, and some people see it and they find it hilarious. But it seems like at another time you said that your favorite things to make are things that are funny but also hurt a little bit. And so I'm wondering, what is it about that combination that intrigues you? Funny and heartbreaking.
I think that the terrible is the funniest, right? Like, I mean, I make jokes. I mean, the most irreverent things is the things that you need to make jokes about, you know? Like, again, I'm going to quote somebody, but there's a moment in a live Indigo Girls concert where Emma Lee Sailor says, you have to laugh about it because you'd cry your eyes out if you didn't.
Yeah. You also wrote a play called Cleo, Theo, and Woo, which has been described as a feminist historical space romp musical. And it is about how we are only as powerful as the least privileged among us, how feminine energy gets attacked, and how we don't give ourselves permission to have righteous rage. But time travel is also a part of Cleo, Theo, and Wu. It's also very much a part of mess in a quantum kind of way. What is it about this sort of multiverse, quantum time, everything, everywhere, all at once-ness that intrigues you so much?
My favorite person in the world when I was a kid was my grandpop, and he died when I was in fifth grade. And then my best friend, Michael, died of AIDS in 96. And I got to be there with him through a lot of that. I mean, no, that's a lie. I got to be with him through some of it and then not. But I was there and we had some talks, you know, we had some big talks about what I was going to go and do. And I remember he wanted me to get a tattoo and he wanted me to become famous. And I remember, like, okay, fine. I still don't have a tattoo. And he would say, I'm going to make things with you. And he was a musician. He was the best. When I was a kid, you know, I was terrified of, I wouldn't sleep for long periods. I'm terrified of sleeping at night for both what would happen and just the fall of sleep, the loss of control. So I have a lot of, like, I need to know that endedness is not a thing. So even if it is a thing, I think that this is how I get through the day, but I really don't believe it is. And I feel like I have people that I love. I have people that I love that are like the most talented people in the world. Scott McKinley and Judy Levin and Michael Hammond. And, you know, fuck it. Even my dad, who like wanted to do these things, wanted to make these things, and they didn't get to. And this idea, whether it's their own fucking fault or not, because my dad is one of those people, like, when I perform, I'm like, you can show up, but stay over there. But like, you get to co-mingle with all that energy that's come before you and after you. I really want that to be true. I just want it to be true. And I love Neil deGrasse Tyson enough to believe in the nonsense that that's not, but I really have decided that it is. And I have enough evidence in my own life to prove it. And whether I've made that up or not, I do. And part of that is when I write. And like that theme constantly comes through me. And I do not, like, I sit down and it screams at me to write things. Like, I don't go like, I want this and this is how this, that's not how it works.
Given all the writing you do, in addition to acting, all the plays you've written, all the episodes you've written, do you consider yourself a playwright?
Oh, I say that I am. And it's so funny because you go, given all the things, and I'm like, I mean, and I'm only saying this out loud because I bet there might be someone listening to this who's like, well, I'm not a writer because I've only, and I'm not, I don't feel like a writer. So there. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel, I feel like a freaking fraud. And then you just push through it. I mean, that, you know, another thing that I think about, my therapist talked about one time about beauty, because I have these hangups about it. Growing up, I used to be called ugly so much. And I smelled funny and I had weird posture and I dressed strange. And like, it was so much a part of who I was. I was treated like I was so disgusting and I felt so disgusting. And I remember my therapist talking about what real beauty is this like believing you're one thing and the act of pushing through and acting, giving yourself that right to be in that energy of beauty, which exists in all of us, that's what's beautiful. That's beauty, is to watch that tension between not collapsing in your own and moving through it. That's what it is. So I like to think that same thing of being a writer, being anything. It's like the tension of holding on. And I'm only collapsing because I'm sharing it and I'm going back into it and going, yes, I consider myself a playwright. But that's the process I go through, is I'm like, I'm not. I was coming here. I'm like, I can't believe I'm going to do this thing with them. You're like, push through. You have to push through it because I'm always going to be in this little body that does this little dance.
You introduced me to a quote from Neil Gaiman, who I also adore, who stated that most of writing is getting ready to write.
Oh, my God. I get ready to write. So there's a lot of getting ready. And I forget to do that. And he's so very good at that stuff. And he's so affirming of people's, you know, things. I remember when he came to Mess, he had given me an advanced copy of Ocean at the End of the Lane. And I hadn't read it yet. And I walked out to say hi to him, and he brought Michael Sheen. And they're both staring at me like in wonder. And I was like, what's going on? And he said, have you read the book yet? And I said, no. And he said, I didn't think so. And he gave me a hug and he said, this is in the same waters. You got it from the same waters as the book. And it was like, that to me is like such a writer who like can acknowledge the specialness of creation, period, but doesn't, it's Neil freaking Gaiman who's not taking ownership of it, like, it's mine. It's like, we all go to the water and we get what we have, you know what I mean? And we make sure, I think getting ready is like, you make sure your buckets are, you know, properly weatherproofed and you have buckets. And sometimes I come with like a teaspoon and whatever, you gotta be like, nope, you gotta go get more stuff so you can get more water.
It's so interesting because when I was watching Mess, I could understand why Neil loved it. It was so apparent to me, and I loved it too. But I want to talk about Curtains, because in 2020, you wrote and animated your short story, Curtains, and it's been accepted in film festivals around the globe. I really think it's one of the most wonderful things that you've made. And before we start talking about it, I'm wondering if you could share just a little bit high altitude plot line of the story for our listeners.
I had a situation where I got in a dangerous situation. You want me to tell them specifically?
Yeah, if you
so
can.
I went to a dance class. I was in a particularly weird part, a vulnerable part of my life. And I thought, I'm going to go to this dance class and be free and whatever. And I was feeling really good. And I was in one of those, you know, moments. And I got into a fender bender on the freeway. And it wasn't my fault, but it was like, it was a utility truck that hit me. And I was like, go ahead. So I was in this fender bender just by myself, basically, because I told the guy who hit me, like, just go.
And then, he hit you from behind, by the way. So anybody that hit you from behind,
oh,
it's their fault.
Sorry. I know that. But he was, it was like a utility truck and he looked terrified. And I'm a fucking girl on a TV show. Like, and I kind of operate like that. Like, I mean, capitalism has served me well, I guess, but I am a social, I'm like, we need to share this shit. Like, it, you know what I mean? So that was going to make his day like really hard, and it was going to be a blip on my radar. So it was like, go, go, go. But my fender was all jacked up, and like I couldn't drive my car, and a tow truck came. And the cops came at the same time, and then the tow truck wasn't supposed to stop because I was supposed to call for one, but it was there, and he was like, the tow tray place is right down the street. So I was like, okay. And I was wearing my contacts because I wanted to be like, I was trying to be like girly and shit. And sometimes we get told stories, right, that glasses make us look not attractive. Suck it, world. We're with very attractive people. So I got in the guy's car, the tow truck. I was so panicked. You know how you're shaking. I left my phone. Everything had gotten jostled. And I didn't know where it was. And I got in the car, and he didn't take me to a tow truck place. We drove for a while. He got very aggressive. And I immediately, when I got in the car, I was like, oh my God. Like, I know that world because I've been in traumatic, you know, I've dated people. You know what I mean? I know the energy. So the second I got in the car, the energy changed, and I was in suddenly a dangerous situation. And what got me out of it was Criminal Minds. I ended up having to convince him that I was on this show, because I did not know what was going to happen. And he ended up eventually taking me to the tow truck place. And I had written a short story about it, written the short story that the film became, and I had performed it once, and people came up afterwards, man, all different kinds of people, like, that was really important, or that happened to me. So whenever that happens, you're like, oh, that, I've got to do something else with this. This is important. Like, that's like mess. Like, oh, I got to do something. This isn't done. So I told my friend Brendan, who has this, he has his own little projection, not little, it's impressive, Jigsaw Ensemble. And he said, you don't want to make this in a regular short film, Kirsten. This should be animated, because I know you. You, first of all, will have to lead it, but also you don't want to go through take after take of doing that. It should be animated. And I was like, okay. And then I thought, this is great, because the story is not about, I used animals instead of people, which I think is perfect, because then you're not looking at, oh, well, it's because he's, I don't know, a guy. In the story, the guy speaks not a language that I speak. And I didn't, that's not part of the story. The story is not about, like, that's not part. And it immediately becomes like, it levels the playing field or something. And it was really beautiful, because I got to write it, direct it, tell the animator specifically this is what it should be. And we did a scratch recording, and that's the recording we used. So I only had to do it once. And then I made it. And then Brendan was like, I'm putting it in every single, put it in every single film festival. And then the pandemic happened. And, you know, it's so funny, because my manager, my agents, they were like, it's fine, but I don't know. What do you do with it? I was like, I just need the world to see it. I don't need it. And that's why I make things, which could be a problem, but I'm just like, I just want someone to see it. And so my intention of getting it out, I wrote every publication, but it was like, it didn't get picked up anywhere, but it got into some film festivals. And so I just slapped it up on Vimeo, and you can just go, you can just look it up, and there it is, and you can watch it. And
well, we'll provide a link for our listeners, yeah. But it's beautiful. Curtins investigates the idea of vulnerability as a source of power, which is your superpower, I think. And the emotional curtains that we lay over our essential selves. And the main character is a cat. Cats are also a recurring theme for you. They're also in mess. So I'm wondering, why cats?
When I was in fifth grade, my sister got to go back east to a family wedding, and I did not go. And I had to be alone with my parents for 2 weeks, which required me to hide in trees and gather food from the yard. And one of those days, there was a, God, my mom's gonna, Mom, I love you so much. We were all going through it. And someone abandoned a cat. We lived right by a field, and someone abandoned a cat in the front yard, and they had slammed the car door on its tail, and so its tail was hanging off. My mom took it to the vet, got it fixed up. They had to shave the little amputated tail. It looked like a little sausage on his butt. And I named him Gink, and he saved my life, that cat. Like, he drooled on me. He held me. He loved me. He liked to nurse on my clothes. And he became this giant beast of a cat. and very masculine and very trained on me. So no matter what was happening in that house, it was like I had a dire wolf who was just like there, like who was witnessing everything. Mm. And it was really valuable to my upbringing to have a masculine energy, a positive masculine energy, because I was not raised with someone who cherished me. I had to learn how people, I mean, I'm still learning, you know, and I'm way farther ahead now, but like, oh my God, I did online dating during the pandemic and I taught myself so many things about masculine and feminine and being queer and all, oh my God, like, but like, and I use even in through that, like the gink energy, like, do they have the gink energy? I recently, in Criminal Minds, we have a kitten in some of the episodes and he was a rescue cat. They got a black little rescue cat. And then they were going to send him back to the shelter. I took that cat home. I now have four cats. Yeah. And his name is Gink.
Good. I've had a couple of soul animals over the course of my life. And as I'm getting older now and going into like the third or the fourth round of a new pet, I'm starting to think, oh, maybe I can bring back some of those old names that I love so much.
The only hard part is they have to live up to the name. Yes. And so he's still like, it's a big mantle. Yo.
Very big.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to talk with you about is your work with Theater of Note. You mentioned it before. You've been a member of the theater for over 20 years. How did you first become involved with the organization?
When you're in Los Angeles and you're an actor, you need places to do it, especially when no one's calling you to do it anywhere else. So that is a really great space to do it at. And I had a friend years ago who was a reviewer, and she said, you should audition at Note. And I went, I did, and then I went to a play there, and it was like they were doing this play called Clytemnestra at Home, which was a retelling of Clytemnestra. And it was like so amazing. And it was just this tiny black box with one bathroom. And the fact that they could reorient the stage and you could be anywhere in this black box. I'm very into like, you know, like I like to make clothes like my, I like to, I mean, I'm not a sewer, but like I'll cut a thing off, or like I like to do things my own way. And that like, sort of nothing there that you could just create stuff was very appealing to me. And I stayed, and also it was like acting class, you know, because you're working with all different kinds of people, all different kinds of acting levels. And I just stayed. And also theater is like, it's so important. It's the beginning of conversations. I did a play there called Fucking Wasps, and it was about Kinsey. And I remember we worked on it for like 6 months, and we were opening and no one was coming and I didn't have any money. And I watched them plaster the movie Kinsey billboard up across the street. And I was like, we made that happen. Like the collective unconscious of theater is so valuable. And it's one of the places where people of different upbringings, cultures, races, ages, you're all together in the same space. I mean, church is like that, I guess, but like theater is so specific because you're all in love with the same thing, and it forces you to make a community, to make a family. And it's so important that we have places like that, and people don't force themselves to be in that. And I realized when I was doing Criminal Minds, like there's art and there's commerce, and like it's not always going to fill your art well. And Note is its own, you know, group of bananas, but I chose to stay there and be a member because it's like, it gives back to me. People go, oh, it's so great that you're, no, it's part of my street cred. It makes me cool that I get to hang out with those people. And they do relevant and sometimes clunky and so whatever stuff. But it's like, those are the people, I want to hang out with the people that are willing to get in the middle of the arena for the sheer purpose of doing it. Not because someone's going to come, not because someone's going to, you know, not because you're getting accolades or getting paid for it. And like, I feel really passionately about that.
Kirsten Vangsness, thank you so much for making so much work that matters. And thank you for joining me today on Design.
Oh my God, what a pleasure. What a dream.
You can learn more about Kirsten Vangsness and all the work she has done on her website, kirstenvangsness.com. You can currently see her in the world premiere of the play Nimrod at the Theater of Note in Hollywood, California. This is the 18th year we've been podcasting Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters is produced for the TED Audio Collective by Curtis Fox Productions. The interviews are usually recorded at the Masters in Branding program at the School of Visual Arts in New York City, the first and longest-running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Emily Wyman.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.